Maybe. There we go. The Cinema Specialists are back. And we're here with episode number 5. If you haven't seen that, we just had the longest. It just sat there staring at us saying it was going to go live. And it just did not want to move. It felt like a day, but I think it was only 5 to 10 seconds, but much longer than usual. Today, we are talking Sicario and The Nice Guys. Sicario from 2015, The Nice Guys from 2016. We decided to do this because The Fall Guy with Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling came out this week. Was it this week that it officially came out? When did it come out? Did it come out already?
It comes out this week, I'm pretty sure.
There you go. So it comes out this coming week. So important to note. But excited to sit down and talk about these two movies. I feel like Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling, they've both become obvious household names. Nobody's surprised when they show up in movies or TV shows or any of that fun stuff. However, I feel like people kind of forget the beginning of Emily Blunt's career here. I feel like now she's become such a household name. But early on, like when Emily Blunt would show up and stuff, I mean, The Devil Wears Prada in 2006, you would think, wow, like she was on to something there. But really, it took until like 2014, probably with Edge of Tomorrow, maybe The Adjustment Bureau. But she's a really small role, not a really small role, but she's a pretty small role in The Adjustment Bureau. And then A Quiet Place in 2018 is what most people kind of look at as the start of her. But in 2015, Denis Villeneuve decided to throw her into an action political movie about drugs.
Yeah, I don't know how to classify Sicario as a movie. I was thinking about it as I was writing my review. It's like, it's not really an action movie, but it's not really like a crime thriller either. So what do you classify Sicario as?
And I think that's why the first time I watched Sicario, I didn't love Sicario. And I'm happy I have watched it since and now watched it this time and kind of give myself a new feeling on what the movie's all about. But I do feel like that's where Sicario kind of, you know, fell a little flat for some people when it first came out. I know it was popular. You know, Taylor Sheridan went on a run here, 3 movies in 3 years, this, Hell or High Water, then Wind River. He wrote all of them. What's up, Jordan? He's dropping in to say hi. Good to see you. It's been a while. I don't know where you've been. We need you. We got to get Jordan and some others out here promoting. You haven't seen that, so we can get up over 100 views on all of our on all of our episodes. My goodness, we're going the wrong direction, John. But yeah, Sicario was very popular, and it really was the movie for Denis Villeneuve as well.
Yeah,
that put him on the map. I mean, before this, he had done, I want to make sure I'm actually getting the order of his movies correct, but before this, he had done Incendies, which, you know, was somewhat popular. He had done Prisoners, which a lot of people really enjoyed, but it didn't really get the credit that I think it deserves. I mean, I think Prisoners, you could argue, is his best movie. I know he has a lot of great ones, but you could make that argument. Prisoners is awesome. And then he did Enemy. So he kind of, it was kind of like, okay, where is this guy's career going? Is he somebody to really watch? And then when he came out and did Sicario, it kind of just like blew everybody away. But yeah, I agree with you. All of that's to say, I don't really know what to classify it as either. It's like a, let's see what IMDb actually classifies it at. They have it at action crime drama. It's an action with very little action. It's a crime movie with a lot of like different kinds of crime. You know, it's not like your typical crime, like noir or anything. Mm-hmm. And it's a drama, but your protagonist kind of takes a back seat in a lot of the movie. So anyway, John, let's talk Sicario. I don't really care which one we talk first, but I've started with Sicario.
I mean, we started with Sicario, so we might as well keep going with it. And yeah, I mean, I'm a big Denis Villeneuve fan, right? I love Arrival. We talked about that when we did our top 100. I have since added Enemy to my top 100 because I absolutely adore that film. And I think one of the biggest things with Denis Villeneuve, and one of the big things that Sicario really shows, he has such a different style than so many people, and he can kind of pivot between the way he tells a story so easily. And Sicario, to me, feels like that type of movie that grips you really early with some very tense moments and never gives you a moment to stop feeling the tension.
Yeah, it stays almost documentary-esque, mm-hmm. right? Like, it feels like you're really watching events unfold as if National Geographic hadn't edited it together yet, or the History Channel yeah. hadn't edited it together yet. And so you're watching these events unfold in a very specific manner, but that opening is harrowing. Like, it's one of mm-hmm. the craziest openings you'll see in a movie, and it hooks you right away. I had mentioned in my review, my biggest complaint with the movie is that Emily Blunt being the protagonist does feel like she's not as relevant throughout the movie as she is like in the opening and everything like that. And it feels like she is, you know, she's a pawn, but that is the point of the movie. She mm-hmm. is a pawn. She is being dragged through. And it's kind of like how the systems need to be abused and broken and all of those things in order for change to happen, or for you to be able to take down the cartel that you're trying to take down anyway, all of that fun stuff. But that opening sequence, it's almost like the rest of the movie, the first time I watched it, didn't live up to that opening sequence in my mind. And I think this second view, this was only the second time I've seen it. I think this second viewing, I got it so much mm-hmm. more than I got it the first time with that opening and then everything that followed. But the opening is absolutely insane.
Yeah. And I think that is one of the many complaints that you get levied against this film, is that the first 30 minutes are very, very tense, keep you really drawn in the entire time. And then it kind of meanders a little bit as it gets to the end. But that home invasion sets up everything you need to know about this world. It sets up how dangerous this world is. And of course, this is New Mexico post Breaking Bad. So everyone kind of has an idea of like yeah. what happens in New Mexico. So, but as we're approaching that house, as we see Emily Blunt taking control and leadership of her team and everything, you know something bad's going to happen. And as it leads up, it feels like the bad doesn't come for far too long in that opening sequence. Because we get there, the house is empty, you're kind of expecting like gunfire and like people, a shootout right away to start this movie. You don't get it, everyone's kind of confused, and then they find the bodies. And then it takes that moment to breathe while they look into how many bodies are in the building. Everyone comes and they check it out. Then the bomb goes off.
And that's kind of what's crazy about this scene is you're expecting the reveal of the bodies in the walls to be the showstopper. Mm-hmm. And you know, they go in. I mean, having the car just crash through the wall is awesome.
Yeah.
Really exciting scene. Super fun, different way of doing it. Then they're going through the house. They're checking all the rooms. You know, it's, are they going to get shot? Obviously, Emily Blunt's not going to get shot. Although I was a little concerned for Daniel Kaluuya because he was not that mm-hmm. famous when that movie came out. So I was like, damn, Daniel Kaluuya about to get roasted right at the beginning. He does not. Good for him. But then they shoot the wall and they peel back the layers and they say, oh my God. And then they don't even know how many bodies there are. I mean, you get the people yeah. coming in and that's what's happening. So they start looking through the rest of the property. It feels like that's the showstopper. And then Daniel mm-hmm. Kaluuya goes outside and they're messing with that lock in the garage or whatever, the barn, the shed, whatever. And you start saying to yourself, oh man, something else is coming. Something else is coming. Something else is coming. And this is what I'm talking about, where like it almost feels like an unedited documentary sometimes, where this is them getting the footage of what yep. they're going to put on film and like what they're going to release to the TV network or to the studio or whatever. But it almost feels, I don't know how Villeneuve pulls it off, but it feels like you're discovering it alongside all of them. And that's a really hard thing to do. And it's something stylistically mm-hmm. that really works in this movie of it all unfolds very methodically, perhaps to the detriment of the mm-hmm. movie, to be completely honest. So yeah, that's what I got for there.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I didn't think about like the logical progression of this movie, where it makes sense and you can see exactly where it's going at any point, but sometimes that's not what we want in movies. We've often talked about that idea of a suspension of disbelief that you need to get invested in some movies. And Sicario almost feels like it's telling you, don't suspend your belief. This is actually what happens.
Exactly.
And it's, I think it's done in it's accomplished through Villeneuve's direction. I think he's a choice of where, like how deep to use a lot of his shots is important. Throughout the entire film, there are many instances where we get those really close shots and they're contrasting with further away shots. And the depth that he uses in a scene is so important to really draw your eye, make you question what you're supposed to be doing. A lot of directors do this, but a lot of them will position a camera in a specific way so you're like questioning why something's there. Villeneuve almost does it in a way to obscure what's there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like if you think about when this movie came out, when the people did love it. So here's I'm just going to read the log line for it because I think it helps the statement. An idealistic FBI agent is enlisted by a government task force to aid in the escalating war against drugs at the border area between the U.S. and Mexico. So you're thinking that this is going to be like an infiltration movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really not. Until the last 10 minutes of the movie, nothing gets infiltrated. You don't even know who they're really looking for most of the movie. A lot of it is, well, you want more information. Sorry, we can't give it to you. Or we don't need to give it to you. Or this, that, whatever. And so for me, as I'm watching it, you do see Villeneuve's purposeful. Everything's kind of at a distance. It's wide open spaces. Look how difficult this would be to be able to handle all this stuff. I don't know. I feel like this really did set into motion. I actually haven't seen Enemy, so I can't talk into that. But this set into motion kind of what I feel Villeneuve's become known for, which is beautiful cinematography.
Yeah.
And stories that are told in difficult ways.
Mm-hmm.
And Sicario could have been so much simpler. I mean, we see these drug cartel movies all the time. Like you said, Breaking Bad had just come out, was so insanely popular. Everybody wants to talk about Breaking Bad. Everybody wants to make Breaking Bad. And my biggest complaint about Breaking Bad is that it does at times feel too simplistic. Mm-hmm. It feels like at times they're taking the easiest route. I'm not saying it's not a great show. I'm just saying I don't believe it's the greatest show the way a lot of people make it out to seem, because I do feel like they made some easy decisions that maybe weren't the best ones. And I think Sicario really showed how you can, you know, get into all of the underlying themes and all of the understood notions of how America handles drug cartels and like all the corruption and everything that goes on with it. We have the waterboarding scene, which like we don't really see the whole thing, but we get the pieces of it. I think that's smart to not show it. You get the guy walking by and turning off the camera. You're finding out about the tunnel. The reason they're using Emily Blunt is just because they need the government agency to be a part of it. Like this could have been told in such a simpler way where you could have just made Emily Blunt a badass female character who goes in and fucks up the cartel. That's not what they chose to do. And it, no. Thank God they didn't.
Yeah, it works better that way because it almost feels Emily Blunt's Kate just being as in the dark as the audience. Again, like I mentioned audience surrogate so much when it comes to characters. This is one of the best use of an audience surrogate because Kate is established as this badass at the beginning of this movie, right? Like we're seeing her. She's a leader. She's running this task force to try and like stop the cartel in New Mexico and everything. So we're almost at a point where it's a use of dramatic irony to deceive the audience, right? A lot of times with dramatic irony, we know where things are going because we know knowledge that the character doesn't. Mm-hmm. And it's more like tailoring the expectations of the audience because we have an expectation brought on by that opening scene to then see Kate be essentially a passenger for this entire movie. And we are discovering things as she's discovering things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sometimes that can feel like the writer forcing you to stay in the dark for the building of suspense. But that's why it's huge that she is the main character, because if you had chosen to make Benicio del Toro the main character, we need to know his backstory. And that could have been another movie they could have done. I mean, the movie is called Sicario. They could have just made him the main character. They could have started the movie with his... Go ahead.
They did make a sequel to this movie, didn't they?
They did. Day of the Dead or something. I never watched it.
I didn't either. It's not done by Denis Villeneuve, so I wasn't very interested in it.
Yeah, and I mean, I think in that one, I do actually believe that Benicio del Toro is the main character. But the thing is, like, they could have made him the main character of this one. You find out about what happened with his kid, his wife, all of that stuff right off the bat. But it's a totally different movie. Now you're almost making an Inuyaritu type movie where you need to have the cutting between timelines. It's got to be super gritty. It's got to be, like, just disgusting. Instead, because you don't really know if anyone is on Kate's side for the entire movie, that's where you're getting the suspense at the scene where they go to pick up the informant or whatever the hell he is down in Mexico, and they're crossing the border and the car's broken down, and you see how good all of them are and that there are no laws to what they're doing. They do not care. And so if this is from Benicio del Toro's point of view, maybe you're making a more badass action movie. But the mystery surrounding him, the mystery surrounding Josh Brolin is gone, because you just know that they're coming in and they're going to kill everybody. And that's what it is. And if you do that, you can't keep your audience in the dark because it's not authentic. Here, you are allowed to keep your audience in the dark because as Emily Blunt is being shocked by things, we're also being shocked by things. And that's huge.
Yeah. And I think it becomes a different movie if we change it to, like, Josh Brolin's character and Benicio del Toro's character as the main characters. And all, I mean, all, aside from the obvious, this movie is more of a, you said it, it's kind of a documentary, right? It's presenting things the way they are and letting the audience question whether or not it's successful at what it's trying to do. Whereas I feel like if we have that typical, you know, bombastic protagonist, or even like Emily Blunt's character is the one who's corrupt, it's not differentiating itself from a lot of crime movies where we see the corruption within the government and everything like that. Instead, this is an altruistic government agent who is realizing how much corruption there is. But at the same time, like, there's that moral quandary of, like, but is it being done for the right thing? And what is the end goal of it all?
Yeah, because you see her and Daniel Kaluuya going back and forth over and over again, but then they feel like they're too far in. They're not going to back out. They're going to keep going. They got to keep going. They got to keep going. It's almost like if somebody's going to break the law, you want to be there alongside them to make sure they don't break it too far so they don't cross your moral boundary, right? Like, if you know somebody's doing something wrong, you almost can't look away because you want to see if they'll push further than you yourself will push. And in this movie, that's, I think, what keeps Emily Blunt going, is she wants to see, will they push further than her? Will they, are they willing? And obviously they are, but now she is hooked because she wants to see how far they're going to push. And also she wants to see if it works. She wants to see if they can take them down. I mean, the military guys in this are the most stereotypical military guys. And when I was watching it this time, I was sitting there and I was like, man, that's the worst part of the movie. And then after it ended, I thought about it and I said, actually, it's not, because this, that's very important to just have the most stereotypical military guys doing this, because who else would be doing this cartel type thing? It's got to be the America kind of people. Like, it has to be. It's the ones who aren't going to ask questions. They're going to say, screw it, we're going to secure everything. And what's pretty wild to me is, like, 9 years later, the number one topic in the United States of America is securing the border. Whether you're on the side of, you know, open borders, or you're on the side of, you know, closed borders, nobody should be allowed in, or you're somewhere in the middle, that is the hot topic. I mean, you know, you're going to have Biden versus Trump for the second time in 4 years. This was not the number one topic in 2020. It is now the number one topic in 2024. And what's crazy is, though, around the 2015, 2016 time, and then before COVID happened, this was still, like, the number one topic. I remember when, even after COVID happened, I think it was Trump, I don't remember, but he said something about the coyotes coming across the border. And a lot of people didn't know what he meant by that. They thought it was one of his delusional statements, like the drinking bleach thing, where they thought that it was, oh, he's talking about animals. In this movie, they're talking about the coyotes. And I think it's very fascinating to think about how similar a lot of the concerns in the southern part of the United States are.
Yeah.
And not much of it has changed with the cartels and the drugs and all of that stuff. And so I love to watch a movie like Sicario that is now 9 years old, came out in 2015, turns 10 next year. And you really see that, like, this is a timeless movie. Mm-hmm. And to be frank, I rewatched all of them because I got the, I told you this on the podcast before, but I got the American Frontier trilogy where I got Sicario, Hell or High Water, and Wind River on Blu-ray for $15 at a Target. Unbelievable deal. I mean, it doesn't come with any special features, but all the movies work. I've watched them all. And all three of those movies are just so good at capturing time and place and character, which are the three most important things in most movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Sicario, what's interesting about it is going to be capturing time, place, and character that is going to be relevant not just for 2015, not just for 2025, but I think for 2035, 2045. I think it's just going to keep being relevant because, look, the southern border is not the perspective on the southern border in the United States of America. And I know, John, you're Canadian and you're like, dude, I live in Vancouver. Our southern border backs up into Washington State. But the southern border is always going to be a hot pressing topic in the U.S. There's always going to be drugs coming. And like the Juarez scene is just unbelievable. It really is unbelievable.
Yeah, that entire sequence on the Bridge of Americas is one of the tensest scenes in any film. Mm-hmm. And you're just witnessing it. And as soon as they cross the border and you just see the bodies hanging from the viaduct, it's just like, it's immediately established at this lawless place. And they go through and you're like, okay, well, they're pretty like, they're announcing themselves pretty clearly here. Like, it's pretty obvious what they're doing, what's going to happen. You expect the cartel to intervene and everything. They get their guy and they go back on the bridge and then they're stuck on the bridge. And the intensity and quickness that the camera moves between all of these different cars on that bridge, it makes you paranoid. It tenses you up. You're just like, something bad's going to happen. And you know, the entire time we're hearing the directions, right? Don't engage. You don't have to do anything. Stay in your cars. You don't need to do anything until anyone like makes a move or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And then one guy gets out of a car and they're so on top of it as quickly as possible. Nothing happens to any of the characters we've been introduced to so far. Not even like the nameless army guys get hit or anything like that. It's just precision execution done.
I don't think Benicio del Toro misses a shot in the entire movie.
No.
I don't think he misses a shot in the entire movie. And that is so purposeful for that character, obviously. But yeah, I mean, I've never actually like stayed in El Paso, but my wife and I, we drove across the southern states to get to Florida from Los Angeles, went through Phoenix and then El Paso and stuff. And what is craziest about driving through El Paso is you look to your left and it's the U.S., and you look to your right and it's Juarez.
Yeah.
And the difference between those places just from a visual is shocking. And this was the first time I watched this movie after doing that drive and doing all that. And like, as I was doing it, I was like, damn, like, you know, cause like when you're in Southern California, you'll go to Tijuana, you know, and like, yeah, Tijuana's got some certain areas you're not going to go to, but if you just get across the border and go through like the touristy part of Tijuana, like you're fine. I don't know if there is a touristy part of Juarez. So anyway, we're 24 minutes in. I don't want to like gloss over too many things here. So what other points do you want to bring up here to make sure we hit your main talking points?
There are a couple of other really ones that I think we are really important ones we need to talk about. We have to talk about like Silvio's character, who is the Mexican state police officer we see kind of sprinkled throughout.
Mm-hmm.
As a counterpoint to Kate, right?
Yes.
Where Kate is this tool being used by whatever, the Department of Defense, is that what it was? I can't remember.
Yeah.
But Silvio is just this guy doing his job. And you're seeing him in this family setting. You're not 100% sure what he does. And we have these moments earlier on in the film where they say, what was it? I wrote down the line. Watch out or keep an eye out for the state police, right? Because they're not all on our side. And so the entire time you're like, okay, he has to be involved with the cartel somehow. And then when we finally get to that reveal at the end of the movie where Silvio is the person that Alejandro finds and gets him to take him to the cartel's hideout and everything, or to follow the car of the guy they're trying to track down, you're just like, oh, this guy's just like some random guy. Well, this isn't some corrupt person. He is just a guy living there.
The other thing that they really do a good job of is they never tell you, they name the big boss and say nobody knows who he is.
Yeah.
And so you're like, okay, we don't know who this is, so maybe it's him. Maybe this guy who's dressing up and pretending to be a cop is actually like the biggest bad there is in the movie, because they give you so little of him. We see him with his son. Yeah. He's in a shitty living situation, but you're like, maybe that's all it is. But in reality, he is just a corrupt cop. Like, that's all he is he's just a cop who's helping run the drugs and do all of that stuff. But the movie does do a good job of keeping you in the dark about who the big bad is throughout. Because by the end of the movie, when you actually get to the scene at the dinner table, it doesn't matter that you've never seen this guy up to this point. You've seen the horrors of everything. You know how bad he is. Like, you get it from what you're watching. And then you hear the story about what he did to Benicio del Toro's family and everything. And it's okay that the other character, like you said, is a juxtaposition to Kate, where it's just the same thing. It's just, he's on the wrong side of the border pretty much. And he's corrupt. You could argue Kate's corrupt too, but the thing is, she's not the one doing it with drugs and stuff like that. He's the one who's doing it, you know, to provide for his family, but he's doing drugs across the border. So,
It's just, as you're watching it, you're trying to figure out how this guy is going to come into the movie. And then when he does, it's just like, wow, I can't believe that was set up like this.
Yeah, I was into that, that reveal for sure. I also like that John Bernthal essentially makes the same appearance he makes in Wind River in this one. I like the use of the wristbands as the visual cue of what's going on here. I like also that this reveals to you that Emily Blunt hasn't been left alone the entire movie, that they've just been following her the entire time, watching her, kind of using her as bait to try to figure out more information, who's corrupt, who's not, all of that. Huge fan of that for sure.
Yeah, really well done. And I think it really hits home this idea that there is so much corruption in this, that the cartel spreads outside of Mexico. And like, we know it's penetrating into New Mexico based on like how the movie's set up. But this is really the point where you realize it's penetrating so much further than you think, right? I mean, Daniel Kaluuya is like, I thought he was a good guy. Like, he is my friend. But I mean, this is how it goes, right? And this is the reach of the power. And this is the exact same reason why Emily Blunt comes to the conclusion that they're just trying to get the Colombian cartel in charge of all the drugs in Juarez instead of the Mexican cartel.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Because what is it? They're trying to restore order. That's what it's determined, that they need order for all of it. And it feels like, you know, I mean, again, going back to like the whole Trump versus Biden thing, it does feel like sometimes when you watch like media coverage of certain things, it's like there's an order to the media coverage of what feels like chaos. It's not actually as chaotic. It's the people in control of it know what they're doing. It feels chaotic to the viewer, but it's not as chaotic to the people who are putting it out there. And I think this movie does a good job, without getting into politics, without getting into news coverage and things like that, of really stating everybody can have their opinions. Everybody can say what they want to say. The truth is there's a lot of bad shit going on both sides of the border. So, you know, have fun.
Okay. I have one more thing I really feel that we need to mention, because we have been terrible at mentioning composers. But Johan Johansson's score in this film is just perfect. It is a perfect score for this movie. It's very subtle. It's very nuanced. It's so sparsely used that every time it comes in, your heart starts beating faster and you're so worried about anything that can happen. It's a masterful composition and it's perfectly set in the film.
No, it's really good. It really is. And yeah, it does a good job of building the tension and everything like that. I will say the scores in all three of these movies are brilliant. And this is the only one that's not done by Nick Cave. The Wind River and Hell or High Water both have Nick Cave at least involved in some way. I know Wind River, he actually wrote the score for it, but I think for Hell or High Water, he did like some songs or something with somebody else. But yeah, it's the score for these movies. It sets a tone. It really does elevate everything that you're watching. So yeah, big fan of that. And that's it. That's Emily Blunt's movie. Josh Brolin's the best part of it. Benicio del Toro is a close second, but Emily Blunt plays the role she needed to play perfectly. Yeah. She's just a little bit more of a side character, even though she's the protagonist. Or as I like to say, protagonist, because John and I, for all of our patrons, are doing, what do you call it? We're doing Spy Who Shagged Me tomorrow, and then next Tuesday is The Phantom Menace, because the 25th anniversary is coming out. So I was watching the Plinkett review today alongside the movie, and my God, what a treat the Plinkett review is, because Phantom Menace is so bad. When he's like, it's this thing called a protagonist. You're just like, it's so good. If you haven't watched the Red Letter Media Plinkett review of The Phantom Menace, watch that. Then listen to us talk about it next Tuesday. So yeah, protagonist. That's Emily Blunt. Let's talk about a buddy Shane Black film noir that has a little too much coincidence for my taste, but I still like this movie quite a bit. John, you looked like you wanted to say something before I could even talk.
This is the third of Shane Black's four movies we are covering on our podcast.
So I know we did Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. What was the other one we did?
Iron Man 3.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Which one did we not do? Predator or something? John, did you totally freeze? Are you there?
Yeah, I did.
Okay, you can hear me now. Yeah, what movie? What me? Movie do we not do? No. Shane Black.
Yes. Predators or The Predator. The Predator. The 2018 movie in the Predator franchise. That was the last movie he has made.
Leave and Come Back. We're on a delay. Like a solid, by how long it took John to respond to that, that was a solid 10-second delay. So I'll take over here and I'll start talking. Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe, to see the two of them work together in this movie is a really good time. John, that delay was so bad. You got out of here about 10 seconds after I said you should hang up and come back in.
Wow, that's impressive. Yeah, I don't know what happened there, but
I don't know why it froze so bad. What do we think about the Ryan Gosling, Russell Crowe casting alongside each other for this movie?
Phenomenal. The chemistry between these two is hilarious. And a lot of it has to do with which character each of them is playing. Yes, Russell Crowe makes sense as the muscle guy, but the fact that Healy is the less corrupt of the two is what you wouldn't expect from a Russell Crowe character. And Ryan Gosling, I feel, is the opposite. So I think that it's just perfect casting for them. And it allows them to really play off each other, kind of knowing how the other, like how the other role would be if they were playing it.
Yeah. And I think the thing with this movie is Shane Black essentially wanted to make a more comedic, fun version of LA Confidential.
Yes.
That's my opinion. I mean, LA Confidential was in my top. I think it's in my top 20 movies of all time. Like, I love LA Confidential. It's a perfect movie. But you can feel that he's trying to make the more fun version of that movie. You have Russell Crowe essentially playing the exact same character that he plays in that one. Except in that one, he's being used by the police department. In this movie, he is definitely a man on his own mission who's just out for himself. Kim Basinger makes an appearance. There's a lot of everything's going on with porn and people dying because of porn and things like that. You see that with Pierce Pratchett, obviously, in LA Confidential. But this is the kiss, kiss, bang, bang version of that. You get the dual narrators at the beginning that then disappear and then come back. One of them comes back at the end of the movie. Like, it's kind of sloppy. It's kind of messy. But what I always appreciate about Shane Black movies is he knows he's making a movie, and he's okay to let you know that he knows he's making a movie. He's not overly concerned with like, ooh, what are they going to say in film school about my decision to have voiceover narrators at the beginning and then have them disappear, or have Ryan Gosling get so drunk he falls off of a balcony, rolls down the hill, and then finds one of the biggest pieces of evidence they needed for the entire movie. That's not what he's concerned about. And that's good. I like that. I appreciate that. I appreciate that he leans into the style of all of that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you're right. The fact that Holland March is the more corrupt of the two is a nice little twist on it, because you would think that Ryan Gosling is going to play the straight guy just based on the fact that he has a daughter and all that. He's not playing the straight guy at all. That's not his role in this movie. They're both corrupt, but when they actually start having to solve things, it's Russell Crowe's character who's actually more on the beaten path and trying to do it the right way.
Yeah, and I think it's that contrast that Black sets up right away in this movie, and the fact that he is very particular in the way these characters act, it leans into it, and it's, again, it's reversing the expectations of the audience. You don't expect these characters to be this way. You don't expect March's daughter to connect more to Healy and to really hold Healy in such a higher esteem than her own father. Mm-hmm. And it's because of that it just makes these characters really compelling, in the way that you can see these are two broken men who are coming to this realization that together they are better and they can be the nice guys.
They have what the other doesn't. Like, each one of them brings their own element to the table that the other person doesn't bring to the table. Their blind spots are not the blind spot of the other person. And that's what makes them such a good pair. And a lot of times when you see film noirs tend to be one PI. It's one person trying to solve the mystery. It's getting into like the darkness of their soul. That was always the Humphrey Bogart thing, right? The Fred McMurray. It was always, okay, I am going to start to go down this, and we're going to see what it reveals about me as a person and me as a character as I get further and further into the seedy underbelly of everything that's happening. We do see other versions of this. Like, that's not the only option. I mean, LA Confidential is an ensemble piece, but those three characters primarily work alone as they work their way towards solving the mystery. It's not until the very end of the movie that we see Guy Pearce and Russell Crowe start to work together. And so, like, this takes the buddy cop elements of things and puts a film noir on top of it. And I think that's a very fun mixing of tropes there, because I think that there's sometimes where that totally doesn't work in movies, or, you know, sometimes the buddy cop movie can just be so predictable and so boring and just so on the nose. And I feel like this movie does a really good job of balancing those two things. And it always comes down to Shane Black loves to deconstruct genres. Like, that Shane Black loves to wink at the camera and do all of that stuff throughout. Every movie he's ever written, that's what he's doing. Like, he is, you know, Lethal Weapon is a buddy cop movie, but he is breaking down that genre. And to me, this movie really works. It wasn't as good on this watch as it was when I watched it the first time all those years ago. But I really, really, really think that this is just an absolutely fun movie.
And I think that's really what it comes down to. I think that's what Shane Black really strives for. I think even when we look at like Iron Man 3, Iron Man 3 is trying to be fun a lot of the time. Yeah, it's dealing with some very serious topics and like trauma and stuff, but it's trying to be fun. And he doesn't quite capture it because he has to be a superhero movie in the end. Whereas like The Nice Guys and also Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, both of them really get this idea of, is this going to be the best movie you will ever see? No. Are you going to enjoy this movie through its entire runtime? Absolutely. Are you more likely to watch these movies again than one of the like best movies of all time. I mean, how many times can you watch Schindler's List, Phil?
I know. I say that all the time. I can't put it in my top 100 because I can't rewatch it.
But like, this is a movie you'll probably revisit more frequently than never. Right? Like, Shane Black just understands that by deconstructing these genres and framing them in a comedic way, it makes it so much easier to make them accessible and rewatchable. And that's what he's going for here. He's not going for pristine cinema. He is going for enjoyable cinema. And sometimes it feels like that heart is missing from movies that come out nowadays.
Well, yeah, and especially movies of this genre, they might try to take themselves a little too seriously. And I think, like, you can have the dark, brooding film noir work absolutely perfectly. But sometimes they forget that you're supposed to laugh while you're watching a film noir. I mean, if you watch Double Indemnity, which to me is the best film noir of that era, because I would say Chinatown is the best, but that's more of, you know, the neo-noir, whatever. Don't need to get into that. But I feel like Double Indemnity is the best film noir of the 40s era. Mm-hmm. You're laughing your ass off during that movie. Yeah. I mean, Billy Wilder's script is electric the entire movie. And then sometimes you get into these cop movies where they take it a little too seriously, or the jokes are tired ass jokes, because we've seen so many cop movies now over and over again. And Shane Black's entertaining, and Ryan Gosling, Russell Crowe, and Anjori Rice all understood that that's what they were going for. I mean, the guy who plays Blueface is so funny in this movie. Like, they really all understood. Margaret Qualley's very good. Mm-hmm. They knew what role, what kind of movie they were signing up for when they started acting in this. And I really appreciated that they all played off each other so well. Because, I mean, for Anjori Rice, I don't know how old she was when she did this movie, but she was young.
15 when this movie came out.
15 years old, Anjori Rice is. For her to nail the style of what Shane Black was going for so well, It's just phenomenal. Like, good for her. And I mean, Gosling, his physical humor in this movie is really what sets it apart. The scene where he's taking the shit, he can't open the door. You know, when he's trying to make the noise because the dead body is sitting next to him, but he can't. When his arm gets broken, there's so many great Gosling moments, and a lot of them are more physical than one-liners. But then it has the scene where, oh my God, this is what it is. It's over there at this hotel. What are you guys, idiots? Of course it is. It's not a flight. And then they drive over, and he turns and there's nothing there. And he's like, all right, so it's probably at the airport. And like, that type of stuff is just great. Gosling was on a heater in this era. I mean, this came out the same year as La La Land.
Yeah, it did. And but he then went on and did Blade Runner the year after? So the year after, or 2 years later?
That was the year after then he did First Blade Man Runner in 2018. And then that's when he said he's retiring. Came back and did The Gray Man, which I never saw, but probably wasn't very good. And then he does Barbie and gets an Oscar nomination, and now he's back. Like, you know, he was on a heater. And this, and before The Nice Guys was The Big Short.
Yeah. I think it's good. And this movie, I remember it being very present when it came out, but I don't remember it being very well loved when it came out. Like, I don't remember a lot of people talking about it.
Box office wise, it was not great. And that kind of is a shame. And that's why you don't see Shane Black doing more, because it really didn't make, it was an estimated $50 million budget. Mm-hmm. And it made $71 million worldwide.
Right. Yeah.
No, not enough. I mean, in the US, it only made $36 million. Like, that's totally not enough. And I think it's an incredibly fun movie. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, it just did not resonate with audiences. This genre is one that audiences are so hit or miss on. And you have to love the fast talking, stupid mistakes. You have to kind of joke. You have to lean into the joke of a lot of the tropes. And if you don't think the tropes are funny, you're not going to like the movie. It doesn't make sense to you. It's kind of just like, whatever, why am I watching this? So, yeah, The Nice Guys was not a box office success. And Warner Brothers put a lot behind it. Like, they were really hoping. The reviews were good. It had Gosling at the height of his power. It had Russell Crowe, who I understand by this point did not mean what Russell Crowe had once meant, but he had done, you know, he still wasn't that far removed from Les Mis and stuff like that. It's surprising how poorly it did. Here's my question. I know we talked about Thor, Love and Thunder and stuff.
Yeah.
What happened to Russell Crowe?
What do you mean? Like what? Like, why did he just disappear off of the face of the earth?
Since The Nice Guys, here's his movies. He was in The Mummy in 2017. He was in Boy Erased. Unhinged, which was obviously the movie people almost died of COVID to go see. Thor, Love and Thunder, very small role. Prize Fighter, The Life of Jem Belcher, The Greatest Beer Run Ever. Poker Face, The Pope's Exorcist, Land of Bad, Ark, the animated series, Sleeping Dogs. What happened to Russell Crowe after this movie? He hasn't made a good movie.
Yeah, I don't know. Great question. That's the Unhinged. I forgot about that movie. That's the one where he drives angry the entire time, right?
Yeah, and that was the movie that was like the first release when movie theaters first started opening post-COVID, and people were like, you're going to go to the theater to watch like old man Russell Crowe being madman?
I don't know. Maybe he just grew tired of it. Maybe he was just like, whatever, this is a paycheck. It'll keep me going.
Machine. He was so good.
He was. I mean, he dominated during the early aughts.
Yeah.
Right? Gladiator, Master and Commander, which we talked about on the podcast about how...
Beautiful Mind, Cinderella Man, Lieutenant Yuma, American Gangster. Yeah.
Like, he just, I guess, aged out of Hollywood.
Yeah, let's see if there's anything specific that happened. What happened to Russell Crowe? Let's see if anything specific. Why is he here? You go, man. On our movies, why, how has Russell Crowe been relegated to a B-list actor? 943 upvotes.
Oh, wow.
Let's see. I don't know. People are kind of saying what you just said, where it's like maybe he just wants to chill.
Yeah.
Yeah, look at De Niro and Pacino. Celebrated actors in their day who definitely went for easier roles later in their career. Maybe he just got tired of it.
Sometimes, like, I mean, when you have an Academy Award, I'm sure you can just kind of coast on your laurels a bit, right?
I mean, he still, when he does get put into a movie, people still talk about the fact that he's in the movie.
It's true. Like, you know? He's still a recognizable name, and he's so good in this movie.
He's great in this.
He's fantastic in this film. He just brings this gravity, and honestly, like, yeah, I kind of mentioned it earlier. His chemistry with Anjori Rice in this is phenomenal. Because it really shows the heart of Healy as a character. And just like, yeah, he's this guy who gets paid to beat people up. But you can almost, like, it's almost like he has this potential to be a better person. And that's what this entire movie is exploring.
Yeah. I think it's exploring like that both of them can be better and they both want to save the people, but do they want to save the people for themselves or for other reasons? And then it gets, you know, corruptness of the State Department and all of that. And you're like, okay, I get it. I get it.
No, that part's great. I love that aspect of this movie where it gets so, I know you talk about like how convenient some of the things are. And yeah, there's a lot of, you know.
Oh, that doesn't bother me at all. Yeah, this part doesn't.
But like the absurdity of how much the like State Department's getting in with the catalytic converter and everything and just getting behind the automotive industry and everything. It's hilarious because it gets to the, and Shane Black did the exact same thing in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, right? Mm-hmm. He loves making you have no idea who the villain could possibly be. And then as soon as it's revealed, it's like, this is the most ridiculous possible conclusion we could have come to.
Yeah. This woman is trying to kill her daughter because her daughter is going against everything, and then so she makes a statement movie, but then the statement movie is also kind of an adult dirty movie. And I mean, you have the whole killing the birds thing, and that scene with the protest is just phenomenal. I love that scene so much. With the we're dead thing, that's just great. But anyway, yeah, I agree with you. Like Kim Basinger also playing that role works so well.
It's so good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's the only time we really see her. We get her once, like she's in that one scene, and then we get her at the very end of the film, and that's it.
Yep.
But you know it's her, and you know, and again, like you said, like, I mean, obviously there's the connection to LA Confidential with this and everything. It feels like it's a necessary casting because of that.
You know? Oh, I agree. I totally agree. And I think when you're making a movie 20 years after a movie as classic as LA Confidential, you should be winking for the people who are watching.
Yeah.
What else about the nice guys?
Do you feel like there isn't enough investigation into March's backstory in this movie? Like, we get it. We get it as exposition. We get the fact that he can't smell, so he didn't smell the gas leak in his house, and his house burned down, and his wife burned along with it. Do you feel like there's never any emotional payoff for that?
I think the emotional payoff comes through Andrea Rice. I think her being at the lot next door and realizing that is her house, like the house that burned down and all that, I think that's more important. I think it kind of explains why March is so obsessed with trying to help women throughout the movie. He is like, you got to think like the people who he's talking to are all women, the ones that he is going and helping, that he keeps picking up the cases for. He's obsessed with this porn star who is like, you know, her death. How is it related to things? I mean, you know, that's a, oh, it seems like with porn stars, you just kind of assume that there's something going on behind the scenes. Like, how did you get to this point in your life? And then you do see him going really out of his way to try to help Margaret Qualley. He's got a lot of interactions with his daughter's friends throughout the entire movie. So I actually think that the payoff comes from Andrea Rice and his relationship with women throughout the movie. The one thing that I do appreciate, because in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Shane Black elects to show the backstory of how Michelle Monaghan got there and everything like that. I think it's better not to show that. And I think it fits the genre better. If you really think about it, what makes this work, I always think about the scene, the post-coital scene in Chinatown is so unbelievable when Nicholson's talking to Faye Dunaway and you understand what Chinatown now means to him. The stories being told by the characters, I feel, are more important than showing what really happened, because these characters, you're not sure if you're supposed to believe them 100% or not.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And it's the same with, it's kind of the opposite of what we get for Healy in this, where Healy, they talk about the diner guy, right? And they actually show us what happens at the diner.
Yeah.
But it's not like that entire story is like, okay, cool, like this guy's actually badass. But there's that one line he delivers after he's done there. Well, just for a moment, I felt useful.
And it's just,
it's just like, it hits you like a ton of bricks. It's like, oh, this man is just looking for purpose in life.
Yep. And that's where your disgruntled PI starts to come in, right? Like the disgruntled PIs always have to have that. Oh, I was looking for purpose. I was looking for something. You know, I never was good at anything else, so this is where I went. Yeah, that diner scene is great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there are other great moments in this movie that I think really stick out. Like, obviously, we get the investigation and everything, and we have the porn party, and then we have the, I think, like, one of the best scenes in the movie is as they're getting out of the elevator. So funny. And it's just like, everything's going down and they just back right back in and go down. It's so funny.
I love that scene. That scene's phenomenal. Yeah. And they just go right back. Nope. And then you see the guy get thrown out the window. He's just flying by as they're going down the elevator. No, I love that scene. I think that scene's absolutely tremendous. And it's that kind of humor though, right? Throughout the entire movie, even the guy gets hit by the car and he's flopping around there and we're still getting him talking and making noises and stuff. I mean, it's brutal. It's depressing, but you're still watching it.
Yeah. Or honestly, the dream sequence might be one of the most out of place parts in this movie, but the payoff for that scene is on point. Just like,
because what is it? He says, I thought you told me this. And he's like, no, that was in a dream. What is it again?
It's the ankle gun.
That's right.
It's the ankle gun. Because Russell Crowe, like, puts his leg up on the dashboard and shows him this ankle gun. And it's at that point where it's like, you're still not 100% sure if it's a dream or not. And then after that, he says that the car is self-driving. And it's so fun. Like, it's just so fun. And it's so great to have that much payoff for a sequence that seems like it's the payoff itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I totally agree. I love that. And the funny part about it is, you do forget as you're watching, even as he's trying to reach for the ankle gun, I'm like, oh, what's he going to do? What's he going to do? What's he going to do? Like, get the gun, and then the gun's not there. And you're like, oh my God, that was part of the dream sequence. Like, it really does lure you in. It's really well done.
Yeah. It's just how Shane Black manages to craft something, how he manages to make it so that it's a clever way to write, where you're focused so much on character the entire time, but he still has these little moments that feel like plot moments.
Yeah. You have anything else on The Nice Guys?
If you haven't watched this movie, you have to go watch it. Like,
yeah, it's fun. It's
very underrated, and it's just very unseen. It's so much fun. You'll be laughing the entire time. It's ridiculous. It is absolutely ridiculous in the best way possible. And it's kind of a shame that we haven't had a follow-up from Shane Black that was like a traditional Shane Black movie, because he did this thing where he did like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Iron Man 3, The Nice Guys, then The Predator, and The Predator bombed so much that he's never been able to do anything again. I'm just hoping that we get another Shane Black neo-noir comedy 10 years later again.
Yeah, the crazy part with Shane Black is that he makes good movies, but they're always box office flops. You know, like, you know, when he did the Lethal Weapons, obviously those weren't, but like, and Predator early on, but everything he's done since like the 90s has been good. It's just, they don't make money. So he doesn't keep going.
Yeah. At this point, my concerns is that if a Shane Black project is announced, it becomes one of those tax write-offs.
Pretty much.
My concern. And it's so harrowing that we live in that type of world now when it comes to filmmaking. But I hope it's not the case. I hope we do get another Shane Black movie. But if we don't, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and The Nice Guys are fantastic inclusions in the neo-noir genre.
Yeah. Did you so let's move off that real quick and end with this. Did you watch the trailer for Mufasa the Lion King, the Barry Jenkins?
I've not watched it yet, no.
I have not either. I just felt like we needed to mention that.
Today, right?
It did come out today. So the Mufasa the Lion King trailer did come out today. Not sure if we needed another live action CGI version of these movies. Not sure if we needed a prequel to the Lion King. This is the world that we live in, as the Killers once said. And so here we are. But I just figured I'd mention that because I'm very curious what Barry Jenkins is about to do with that movie, because I'm a big Barry Jenkins fan, and Barry Jenkins has not made a movie since 2018, right? Because the last movie he made was, let me just make sure, I'm pretty sure it was If Beale Street Could Talk. He was a producer on After Sun, but he didn't direct After Sun.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if you look at his directing, he did a miniseries, he did a video, but he hasn't done a movie since 2018. So I'm excited to see what he's going to do with this. We'll see. Anyway. That's it. Thank you all so much for listening. Hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please remember to like the video, subscribe to the channel, do all of that fun stuff. If you want to be a patron, patreon.com/specialist. We're doing The Spy Who Shagged Me tomorrow. We're doing The Phantom Menace next week. Also next week, a little bit of a schedule change. Our podcast will be Tuesday night at 10:30 Eastern time, not Monday night, for anybody who's a Survivor fan, such as the Fantasy Answer, I guess, right here. Fantasy Answer will have to give me a name at some point. I got to prove if he's telling the truth in that one or not, but I do appreciate you listening. Next Monday night, they're doing a Survivor event in Miami down at FIU. So I will be at that, and I will not be podcasting with John that night. So we'll be live Tuesday, and our movies are Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and Westworld from 1973. So the OG Westworld and Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which is the second movie, not the first movie, in the prequel trilogy of, or whatever, the new trilogy of Planet of the Apes, because
it's not a trilogy anymore.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes comes out after that. My biggest fear right now, I will say, as a huge Planet of the Apes fan, I think Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is not going to be a good movie. They are They are playing way too many trailers for it. It doesn't have Andy Serkis involved. I'm starting to get a little concerned that they are concerned that it's not that good, that it didn't play that well. So they're feeling like they need to advertise more, because normally for a movie like this, they would not be advertising as hard as they are currently advertising. So, man, I hope I'm wrong. I really, truly do hope I'm wrong. I will probably be watching that movie on May 9th in the theater. But I just don't. I feel like I might be in for a disappointment. It makes me sad.
Yeah. So. Hopefully not, because I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah.
It's actually one of my most anticipated movies of the year, so I'm hoping it's not bad.
I know. Dude, me too. I mean, I love A Planet of the Apes. I couldn't believe they were releasing it. I mean, the OG Planet of the Apes was one of my all-time favorites. And I think Dawn of the Planet of the Apes is a masterpiece. Honestly, I think the whole trilogy is a masterpiece. But Dawn of the Planet of the Apes especially is just so incredible from a technological standpoint.
Yeah.
So I'm excited to talk about that movie next week. And I'm really hopeful that the movie is going to be, the kingdom will be good. But we'll see. All right, anybody. Thank you all so much for listening. Hope you enjoyed this podcast. And we'll see you later.